I next met with Dr. Tim Gretton, and to begin, I asked him to discuss a paper that he was an author on, Adjuvant Treatment of Hepatocellular Carcinoma, Prospects for Immunotherapy, and to comment on how frequently community-based oncologists encounter patients with HCC who require adjuvant treatment.
It's certainly not a very common scenario in general. Now, in HCC, I would still think it's actually a little different. And the reason really is that, number one, as you know, we do screening. Patients with cirrhosis undergo surveillance, so we do find patients with early disease. Once you have patients with early disease, you know, we have curative treatment options, surgery, radiofrequency ablation, which are very, very effective and lead to very good outcomes, 5-year survival rates of greater than 50% if you limit yourself to patients with small tumors. So I would say, yes, we do find patients that come to our clinic and ask for the potential use of adjuvant treatment in HCC.
It's interesting, though, and I was thinking about this, when you said that you refer not only to post-op, post-surgery, but post-local therapy like TACE?
No, more radiofrequency ablation. You know, nowadays, radiofrequency ablation is just as effective as surgery, okay, and it's widely used.
Okay, so that makes sense, radiofrequency ablation. But I don't know whether you would call it adjuvant, since I guess it's really not curable, but the typical situation where a patient presents with HCC and has disease confined to the liver but not considered curable, would you consider that adjuvant therapy?
Well, you know, obviously what you're referring to is a patient with more than 5 lesions, large lesions, undergoing transarterial chemoembolization. And, you know, even with the best treatments, we've got to be honest, this is still, in most cases, a palliative treatment. And then it becomes very, very difficult for a medical oncologist and a specialist like mine, even very interesting, because the question is, how are we going to sequence different types of treatments? In other words, when are we going to do TACE? How long are we going to TACE? Are we going to add a systemic treatment to the TACE? In the past, all these attempts have been negative. There have been studies using sorafenib that we've used for many, many years in HCC. Those studies were all negative in the adjuvant scenario in combination with TACE. So now the question comes up, you know, should we potentially use the TACE in combination with immunotherapy for different reasons?
Well, the other thing is, as soon as I saw the initial data that just came out with the atezolizumab, bevacizumab, one of the first things I was wondering about, believe it or not, was not just whether it was going to affect first-line therapy, but whether it was going to affect the timing of local therapy like TACE. And, you know, we never really, I don't think, have had a systemic therapy that caused a substantial number of objective responses, I don't think.
No, you're absolutely correct. And, you know, if I may add, there is actually a lot of reasons why this combination may be very effective, other than that you observe responses with a systemic treatment. But one of the things that a lot of people overlook is whenever you perform a TACE and perform an embolization, there is a VEGF shower after the TACE. Because what you do is you induce severe hypoxia in the tumor. All the beads will occlude feeding vessels, so patients develop severe hypoxia in the tumor. And then what happens is that a lot of cytokines, and one of them being VEGF, are being released as a response to this. We do know that this is actually leading to the growth of feeding vessels from other areas so that the tumors can survive. So it would make indeed a lot of sense to combine a treatment targeting VEGF with a TACE procedure.
So in your paper and in many of the papers that we reviewed, you get a lot into the immunology of HCC, but also what I thought was really interesting was, quote, the immune landscape of the liver. So can you take a shot at kind of going through some of that?
Yeah, of course. So a lot of people don't realize that liver is actually a very, I would say, immunological organ. You know macrophages, the cells that basically eat up the trash, for instance. You know, believe it or not, the biggest source of macrophages in the body is the liver. The second point is, you know, everybody talks about the microbiome. We know that, you know, let me use trash, you know, everything that's coming from the intestine, from the small and large bowel, is going through the portal vein and then filtered in the liver. And this is all being done by immune cells. So on one side, you know, the liver has to do a lot of cleaning there. On the other side, we do know that the liver is actually very tolerant. We do liver transplantation, and some of the patients undergoing liver transplantation, you know, don't need immunosuppression after a long period of time anymore, which is very different to many other organs. Heart, for instance, heart transplant, you know, the patients require way more immunosuppression than the liver. So this is counterintuitive in the context of cancer, because the liver is considered to be an immune-tolerant organ, keeping everything quiet and shut. But at the same time, now we see that in the context of cancer and HCC, we can activate immune responses and kill tumors efficiently.
Could I follow up on what you were saying about the microbiome? Because I was kind of flashing on something that Keith Flaherty from MGH mentioned to me in an interview a while back about that interface in the bowel and the liver where the bacteria is, and that as a potential site where immune therapy might be causing toxicity. Any thoughts about that?
You know, that's a very interesting field, interesting question. There are many people working on this. And to be honest, we don't know anything from patients. And, you know, any of these studies have to be confirmed in human and in patients. We do have animal models where we mimic this. They are highly artificial. We use either germ-free mice that are grown up without any bacteria in their environment, or we use antibiotics to treat them. So, you know, we have to take this with caution. Yes, but it is correct. There are many studies, not in HCC so far, which suggest that the microbiome can affect the outcome both of chemotherapy as well as immunotherapy. And it's hard to believe why this would not take place in the context of HCC.
So I want to really focus on some of the new developments, but I did want to ask you in terms of adjuvant therapy and this paper that goes through that, what are some of the key ongoing trials right now that, you know, clinicians should be aware of that are out there that might come out at some point, particularly phase three trials?
Right. So the field is obviously moving very rapidly, as you know. So there are adjuvant studies now post-surgery and radiofrequency ablation using single agents. Anti-PD-1 treatment is certainly the number one. And I know you asked me for phase three, but, you know, the field is really going rapidly. We even now starting to collect very early data on neoadjuvant treatment because it is known in immunotherapy in general that patients with early disease actually respond very well to immune-based approaches.
Wow, that's really interesting. I'm always fascinated by neoadjuvant immunotherapy studies, bladder, lung, wherever. It's just so amazing. And, you know, I keep waiting to see more translational things come out of it, and I'm not sure I've seen too much. Anything happening from a translational point of view? Seems like that's a perfect time to figure out what's going on.
Oh, absolutely. You know, that's just ongoing. I think it's a matter of time. We don't have enough samples, et cetera, but you're absolutely correct. One of the issues in HCC is that we don't get enough biopsies. We don't need biopsies to diagnose the disease. And in the neoadjuvant setting, obviously, you will acquire a lot of tissue that you can study and really see what's going on at the site of the tumor in terms of immune responses.
So actually, yeah, the sort of older question about biopsy or not, I don't know if that changes now that things are starting to change. I've heard people say they're maybe not as comfortable even in a very, very obvious high AFP case or whatever, because maybe they just want to get tissue and look at it, get NGS, whatever. What do you think?
You know, this is a very difficult question. So for the standard of care, it is still very hard to argue that you need in a patient with cirrhosis and clear imaging criteria that you will still need a biopsy. Unfortunately, we don't have good driver mutations or targets that we can utilize and that will translate into a potential treatment. But outside standard of care for clinical trials, absolutely. And then, you know, there are very rare cases. And, you know, sometimes it's difficult. As you know, there is HCC, there is cholangio, then there is mixed tumors. And once we get into these areas, these gray areas, I think biopsies are absolutely required.
So I've been joking recently, incidentally, that cholangiocarcinoma is the new non-squamous cell cancer of the lung because of all the mutations they seem to be finding there. Do you see much cholangiocarcinoma?
Well, we sure do, yes. Unfortunately, it's not as responsive to immunotherapy from what we know as the HCC, which is, again, a very interesting question because remember you asked me about the liver as an immune organ. And here we are. We have two different types of primary liver cancer. The majority of cases in cirrhosis with hepatitis or alcoholic cirrhosis, etc. And then the little brother, the cholangiocarcinoma, arising in a non-diseased liver in younger patients, no gender differences anymore. And this disease appears, at least if we talk about monotherapy from the data that we have so far, not to be very responsive to anti-PD-1 treatment.
Yeah, and I was thinking of targeted therapy because the stuff that I've been hearing about with IDH inhibition and I think FGFR sounds like it might be kind of interesting. What do you think?
Absolutely. It's going to lead into, I mean, I'm convinced, you know, that's going to be coming standard of care very soon, especially I think the IDH mutation, we're a little bit ahead of the FGFR, but I expect both to become standard of care options. And then, and that's what we're currently working on, many are currently working on, the question is, you know, can you potentially use this to make the tumor more immunogenic and combine it with immune checkpoint inhibitors?
Interesting. Anyhow, getting back to HCC, of course, I want to chat with you about the data that did just come out with atezobev and maybe other similar combinations that we might want to look to the future. But I'm going to ask you the question. It seems like I've asked a million times and everybody kind of says, microenvironment, and I never really get it. So I'm going to give you a shot because you're the translational person, which is, what is your vision about really the mechanism of why anti-angiogenics and checkpoint inhibitors seem to be synergistic? Simple question, right?
Yeah, simple question. And, you know, the simple answer is we have a lot of models and we do have some answers. If this is correct, I can't tell you, but, I'm happy to explain to you the models. So number one is a very simple one. We do know that anti-VEGF therapy repairs vessels. So in other words, similar to cytotoxic chemotherapy that cannot diffuse into the tumor, immune cells also have to get into the tumor. And we believe that if you actually fix the vasculature, that will improve T cells invade tumors. That's number one. Number two, we just talked about this. HCC is a highly vascularized tumor. We perform TACE. We use imaging to actually diagnose the disease. So a VEGF targeting approach, I think, is highly likely to be effective in HCC. The third point is VEGF is one of the growth factors that basically makes myeloid-derived suppressor cells. Myeloid-derived suppressor cells are a myeloid cell subset in the environment which instead of maturing into a potent APC, remains immature. And what it can do, and we know this from many studies, it can suppress T cells, NK cells, and other effector functions. So if you treat a patient with anti-PD-1 and you want the T cells to be active, you have on the other side these MDSCs, these suppressor cells, which kind of inhibit T cell function. So basically, this is a different way of releasing the brakes by making these MDSCs go away. You are aware of other approaches, anti-CFSR, for instance, and others where, you know, we try to block the cell population, but it appears that this cell population is really critical in the environment, and it basically hinders the T cells from killing tumor cells. And since VEGF is one of the growth factors for these cells to mature, we block VEGF with bevacizumab, and that's why the T-cell treatment becomes more effective.
Interesting. So from that point of view, do you think it makes much difference what kind of anti-VEGF effect you have? For example, TKI versus antibody, and then which antibody?
You know, you're just asking the question that I'm asking myself every day. It is not known. I have an opinion about this, but we don't know. We don't know, is it the VEGF receptor or is it actually the VEGF as a cytokine, or should you use a TKI? Now, sometimes we also have to keep in mind the clinical perspective. Patients with HCC are sick. They have a diseased liver. And although we've been using TKIs and they have been effective, they've always been associated with a number of adverse events and they have been toxic. They are way more toxic than bevacizumab or any other antibody.
Ramucirumab.
Or ramucirumab.
Aflibercept, right?
Absolutely.
Theoretically.
So you can use any of those, and there are more in development. So I would always favor an antibody. I can't give you a scientific rationale yet why one may be better than another one. From a scientific perspective, you probably want to be a little bit wider and target different receptors, etc. But my fear, and that also refers to a number of the ongoing combination studies, is that an antibody-based approach targeting VEGF is probably less toxic than a TKI.
Absolutely. And another related question, and actually now that I think about it, I asked Chuck this question a few weeks ago in a meeting. I was really surprised at his answer, which is, do you think it matters whether it's anti-PD-1 or anti-PD-L1 in general or in this combination? Up until I asked him a few weeks ago, every time I ask somebody that, they go, no, we can't tell the difference. But he didn't give me that answer. What answer would you give?
Well, this was, I guess, the answer until a couple of months ago. Now we believe that anti-PD-1 is probably more effective than anti-PD-L1.
That's exactly what he said. And I never heard that before. What happened? We're like, what came out?
It's hard to say. And I don't think we have very good data yet. But, you know, obviously the PD-L1, for instance, is actually also expressed on the myeloid-derived suppressor cells that we were talking about. And, you know, it's expressed on many other cells. And if you really want to specifically target immune responses in T cells, I would definitely favor the anti-PD-1 at this point.
Interesting.
But, you know, again, this is all very early and based mainly on animal data. So it remains to be seen if we see the same in patients.
The same thing happened recently with CAR-T. For a while, we couldn't tell the difference, and now we start hear people starting to say things. So it's really interesting as these things develop. So I want to dive into the clinical data that's come out and what you think it means for the future. But I have to ask you one more translational thing, because I saw this paper you had in Hepatic Oncology, development of shellfish allergy after exposure to dual immune checkpoint therapy. I got to hear about that. This sounds amazing.
Yeah, you know, this is the interesting thing. Early in these clinical trials, you learn with your patients. So, you know, this is referring to a case, you know, a very nice gentleman that we treated with a checkpoint inhibitor, and he had no signs of food allergies. And one day he goes to the restaurant and eats shellfish, and he develops a severe allergic reaction, you know, an anaphylactic shock. He had to go to the hospital. He was on the ICU. And it turned out that this was basically something that had never happened before. Now, I can't say for sure that this is due to the anti-PD-1 treatment, but what we do know is the following. Patients, obviously, when they are on treatment, undergo regular CT scans with contrast dye. And we already know for many years that patients on immune-based approaches, that a lot of them actually develop contrast allergies. And, you know, that can be a problem if you have a patient and you want to follow him over time because all of a sudden the patient, you know, you can't do a scan with contrast anymore. But one of the side effects of these checkpoint inhibitors appears to be that allergies are just simply more likely. And it's not only autoimmune disease, but it can be food allergies as well as, you know, contrast allergies.
I have never heard that at all. Checkpoint inhibitors, allergy, nothing. I don't ever remember hearing anything about that. So what's the data? I don't even remember seeing it in trials being reported.
That's possible that it's not being reported.
But you think it happens?
You know, it's very difficult to prove that it really happens because obviously you also expose the patients more to contrast. So it could be just, you know, something that just happens to the patients, and you will really need large numbers to prove this.
So for example, I never really thought about this, but if you have somebody with, you know, say an allergic-based pulmonary asthma, do you see that get worse with checkpoint inhibitors?
I haven't personally seen this, but, you know, you can see the wildest things with these checkpoint inhibitors. I'm treating a patient with type 1 and type 2 diabetes at the same time.
Wow, both newly developed.
Well, he had a type 2, and then he developed a type 1 on top of it.
Yeah, well, I don't know, again, were you at Hopkins when Julie Brammer was there? Because, you know, her famous saying is, if it ends with itis, checkpoint inhibitors can do
yes.
it.
Absolutely. You can see everything, yes.
Anyhow, let's talk about the new data that just came out. I didn't even know there was a ESMO Asia meeting, but I guess they've been having that the last couple of years. This big study presented. And can you talk a little bit about the trial, what it looked at, what they reported, and kind of what you think it means?
Sure. So this was, you know, like many of the studies that we have currently, based on a basket study where the combination of atezolizumab with bevacizumab was tested in different indications. Very early on, there were a couple of HCC patients treated, and first they saw very high response rates. I think it was in the range of 60% or something there at the first ASCO meeting. And so, you know, investigator noticed, you know, there seems to be a very nice signal that we had never seen in HCC. So a phase 3 study was launched in the first line setting in patients with advanced HCC and good liver function. Patients were treated either with a combination of atezo and bev or sorafenib, which has been the standard of care for many years. They were randomized 2-to-1 to the immunotherapy, and the primary endpoint for the study was survival as well as PFS. And this study, to be honest, apart from the result, one of the very astonishing things was how fast this study recruited. It was actually less than 1 year, and about 600 patients were enrolled in this study.
Could I mention another really interesting thing about this study that I kind of didn't realize right away that I thought was pretty interesting, was that they scoped everybody to make sure they didn't have varices before they got in the trial, correct?
That is correct. So there was a, I believe about 8 or 9 years ago, there was actually a single agent study using bevacizumab in HCC, which was done, I believe, in New York, was reported in the JCO. And that study actually started, and they had some bleeding issues in this patient population. And then they basically required every patient to undergo endoscopy just to prevent this, which is something, obviously, that we have to look out for this patient population because of the portal hypertension, low platelet count, and cirrhosis, which is associated with varices. So that's why you have to watch out when you are going to use this in the future.
So when we were discussing this at a recent meeting, somebody in the audience said, well, what about the TKIs? I mean, is there an increased incidence of, I mean, you don't scope people before you start sorafenib. Is there an increased incidence of bleeding?
No, there isn't. We actually published this. We looked at this because we also studied some vascular targeting agents in the past. And we looked at the bleeding events in comparison to renal cell cancer because a lot of the drugs are being used both in HCC. Sorafenib is being used in renal and HCC. And it appears to be not significantly higher. But, you know, you want to play safe. And if you have patients with clear signs of portal hypertension, low platelet count, I think it's a good idea to make sure that the patient doesn't require either bending or medication treatment.
That's interesting. Do you have any idea what fraction of patients who were scoped were found to have asymptomatic varices and got kicked out of the study? I'm most curious how often that happens.
No, I don't know how often that happens. I can tell you from our own experience, you know, it really depends on how strict you are with your inclusion criteria. And, you know, my fear is now with the data out, and I'm going to talk about the data in a second, you know, this is going to go into standard of care. And what are we going to do in standard of care? We've got to be honest. A lot of the patients that we see in standard of care are not perfect trial patients. What is the issue in HCC? A lot of these patients have liver cirrhosis, and they may actually not have a child A, but, you know, they may have a borderline B or a good child B, and they may have severe portal hypertension. And, you know, once we get into this point, I think we really have to make sure that these patients will not suffer from bleeding because these bleedings can be very bad in this patient population.
So even in someone with no sign of portal hypertension, normal platelet counts, you still think before getting Bev they should be scoped?
No, I think, you know, you need signs of portal hypertension.
Okay.
And, you know, it's very easy. You just have to look at the platelet count.
We did a survey of 25 investigators nationally asking them how they treat 4 or 5 GI tumors, and one of them was HCC. And we just said, put aside reimbursement, what's your first-line therapy? And I don't have to tell you that most of them, well, amazingly, I was shocked, really, when I first saw it, said atezo-bev. So let's talk about the data and how they executed the trial.
Yes, so basically, you know, as I said, so it was a phase 3 study, 2-to-1 randomized against sorafenib. And basically, we do know as of now that we haven't even reached the median survival in the combination group. We do know that we have a very good hazard ratio in the range of 0.6, if I remember correctly, so clearly favoring the combination of atezo-bev. We know the landmark at 6 months progression-free survival was significantly longer, about, I believe, 60% versus 80% roughly in the combination of atezo-bev versus sorafenib. The treatment was very well tolerated. There were no unanticipated toxicities. Obviously, we find hypertension and proteinuria in the context of using bev in this patient population, but overall, it was very well tolerated. And maybe allow me to say a few words which have not been discussed so much. If you remember sorafenib, when sorafenib was approved, we actually had 2 co-primary endpoints, and that's kind of gotten forgotten. It was actually survival, but it was also time to symptomatic progression. And that endpoint was never met in that particular study. The drug was approved, and I'm not arguing about the efficacy of the drug, and, you know, it was very helpful for a lot of patients. Now, at the GI ASCO, there was a presentation specifically talking about patient outcomes, quality of life, patient functioning, etc. And it was very clear that patients treated with the combination of atezo and bev basically did better in any of the reported outcomes. I understand there's always shortcomings with quality of life and questionnaires, et cetera. But if you have three different ways to measure this, and it's always a clear difference, I think, you know, it speaks for itself that this treatment is not only leading to a better outcome in terms of responses, survival, progression-free survival, et cetera, but that patients actually do better, feel better on this treatment than they do on sorafenib.
So how much of that do you think is just less toxicity? Because, you know, even indirectly, if you think about Bev versus sorafenib, and how much is it, you know, better control of tumor?
You know, I'm sure it's both. And obviously, you know, we do know, and we, you know, we've been treating a lot of patients with sorafenib, so we do know the adverse events that can be very difficult for the patients. But, you know, I think the important thing for the listener to know is that patients just tolerate this treatment and they do better. And there's nothing better than seeing a patient that actually responds to a treatment and is doing well.
Well, that was the other thing in terms of objective response, because that certainly caught everybody's attention. I think it was about 30%. And maybe you can compare that to what's been seen with single agent TKIs and single agent immunotherapy or checkpoint inhibitors. And just in terms of response, not just the numbers, but the quality of the response.
Right. So usually, regardless of what molecule you use, with a single agent, you can expect to see a response rate in the range of 15 to 20%, 17, 18. I'm talking about the immune checkpoint inhibitor, single agent. There you see 15%. Now, sorafenib, in the initial study, didn't actually show any. Now, in the study against atezo-bev, yes, we did see, I think they reported something in the range of 15% or 12%. So they did see some responses. And you can find this very rarely, to be honest. I haven't seen too many, but I have seen them also. But clearly not as high as this 30%, which is the first time that we see this number in HCC in general.
So another issue comes up in terms of tolerability. While you mentioned that it was well tolerated, one of the issues, as you said, was they had to have good liver function. So at this point, well, first of all, I should ask you, was this data enough for you to want to make this your first-line therapy?
Absolutely. There is no question that this is going to be the first line treatment for patients with compensated liver function, yes. But let me, you know, if I may, you know, the liver function, because, you know, that's, I think, an important factor.
Absolutely. Because that was one of the things that was interesting about the survey we did, is almost everybody was saying atezo-bev, and we said good liver function. But some people started to slip back to TKIs when we started to say, you know, say a Child's PUB, for example, E7.
Right. You know, so the important thing about liver function is the following. If we go to the extreme, patients with poor liver function, Child-C patients, I think it's important for the audience to remember they have a median survival of 6 months. They die from their liver function. They don't die from their cancer. They don't die from their HCC. They just simply die because they have poor liver function. And unless, you know, they can undergo liver transplant, you know, that's basically their fate. And, you know, so this is kind of the two different ends we're coming from. You always have to question yourself, is the cirrhosis or is the cancer the leading factor here and the threat for the patient? Once we talk about Child B, now it becomes more difficult. And, you know, I also want to mention that, you know, the Child classification, now we talk about Child B7 versus 8 or 9. It was never actually developed to make a difference between 7, 8, or 9. This score was developed by surgeons many years ago to identify patients that would benefit from shunt surgery. You know, it was nothing else. So nowadays, I understand that, you know, we use Child A, and then investigators say, well, if it's a B7, you know, he's still good. 8, we don't know. 9, we shouldn't. I think, you know, that's still questionable. I generally say compensated liver function or not, because, you know, that's also clinically much easier to say rather than always going through the score and calculating this. But again, it is an important factor. I'm not so sure if it's safer to go with a TKI into a patient with a compromised liver function than with a checkpoint inhibitor.
I guess the other issue is HCC the new RCC? Because kind of from our sort of global point of view, we saw RCC explode with axitinib IO, and now we're seeing the same thing with HCC. I guess the other issue is, what's this going to mean for second and third line therapy, where all the agents we're using were looked at after sorafenib? So how are we, and also, what about anti-CTLA-4 and PD-1?
We can even add one other question. What about sorafenib?
Right.
There is no sorafenib second line study. You know, that may sound very funny.
I'm not sure. I see a lot of people saying lenvatinib second line. Is there any lenvatinib second line data?
Well, I think there's some very early studies, small studies. But you're right. You know, it's like an explosion. You know, the field, we don't really know what to do anymore. And we have different options. And it's very difficult to say what is the right treatment. And let me explain to you why this is difficult. It's not only the sequencing that we say, you know, we never use this post one drug or et cetera. It's also because patients live longer. So we don't actually know in what status these patients are. If they've been for more than a year, 2 years on a checkpoint combination treatment and how fit they are. You know, the first second line treatment that was approved, the regorafenib, was in patients that actually tolerated sorafenib. You know, that's very difficult to translate now into a patient that was treated on an immune checkpoint inhibitor combination. I guess you said lenvatinib, we mainly know in the first line setting. It's now currently, as you know, also being tested in combination with checkpoint inhibitors. So that data will come out pretty soon. But, you know, what about RAM, ramucirumab? You know, now we already had a patient on a vascular targeting agent. What is the validity? How helpful is it to use these patients? And what is the role of AFP in this particular setting? We have no idea about that. So it's absolutely going to be very interesting, and there is many new things to do.
So again, from my general medical oncology vantage point, the other new little joke I have is HCC the new myeloma? Because when you talk about sequencing of agents in myeloma, it's also all over. There's so many new agents coming in. You know, everybody kind of does different things. And I wonder if that's about where we're starting for HCC. One other thing I was curious about, you mentioned the strategy, well, this strategy in general. And I'm aware, as you mentioned, there's a pembrolizumab, I think, phase 3 trial. And that's already approved in endometrial. They're seeing responses in MS-stable disease. The gynecologists are using it, but also atezolizumab, cabozantinib, I know is another phase 3, same strategy. Any other big phase 3s with that kind of strategy they might be reporting?
Yes, actually, indeed. The combination of anti-CTLA-4 and PD-1. So, you know, instead of bringing in another TKI, basically, you know, making T cells even more effective through this approach, that's currently being tested in phase 3 studies in different scenarios, just by itself, and also using different drugs from different companies. So that's going to be very interesting. We already know that response rates are significantly higher than with a single agent. That data has been presented in form of an abstract at the ASCO meeting. And, you know, then the question will be, is it going to be more effective than the atezo-bev? And what about the toxicity?
Or maybe all three. And, of course, this is getting looked at in a lot of different cancers. It kind of seems like that strategy is being used the most right now in melanoma. I mean, they really use that as their primary go-to. But we'll see whether it ever comes. I know you've looked at, I think, tremelimumab and durvalumab.
Yeah, we tested this as one possible combination. And, you know, it seems to be effective in early studies. And there's a large study ongoing. So, you know, it really needs to be seen. And once we treat more patients, how this will turn out.
So one more sort of basic question before we get into your cases, which is, it always seemed kind of strange that in many cases, it looks, at least globally, like the responses and the benefits that you see from checkpoint inhibitors, and a lot of times doesn't seem to change depending on the cause of the disease. So like with, you know, head and neck, I think about the smoker or the HPV, you know, cervical cancer with viral. And yet you never really see that playing out. It seemed like the perfect place to look at that would be HCC. But again, it's not playing out. Is that correct?
Yeah, you are correct. You know, it's quite surprising. One would expect that if you have a viral disease, it would be potentially more responsive to immune checkpoint inhibitors. But there is no good clinical data yet that would really suggest that that's the case.
I mean, NASH?
That's going to be the big question now. You know, how is it going to turn out in NASH? My personal take on that is I don't think we diagnose NASH well enough yet. So we probably don't know what patient actually has NASH and doesn't have NASH. And if he doesn't have NASH, maybe he just has ASH, which is alcoholic steatohepatitis, which if you look actually on the slide, you know, from an ASCO pathologist, it actually looks very similar to the non-alcoholic steatohepatitis. It's just, you know, that it's, you know, it's going to be very difficult and interesting in the future.
Well, in that regard, is there any reason, because I guess one of the questions about this atezo-bev I Am Brave study was that I think most of the patients were Asian. Should that
60%.
Make a difference? And it was HPV, theoretically, is there any reason to think it'll make a difference?
So if we look in HCC in general across the board, it seems actually that patients with hepatitis C do better than hepatitis B. Applies to TKIs. And also, if we look at the early studies using checkpoint inhibitors, it appears that patients with hepatitis C actually did better than B. I'm not sure if this was because it was a second-line treatment and there were different prior treatments depending on the location where patients came from, but, you know, that's basically what we have seen in the past. So based on that data, you know, we would not necessarily expect a study with the majority of patients coming from Asia to do better than what we have seen before.
So let's go through your cases, beginning with your 66-year-old man presented with weight loss and a screening ultrasound showed a 12-centimeter mass, satellites in the right lobe of the liver. You saw him at that point?
Yeah, actually, yes, we saw him from the beginning. And the question at that point was what type of treatment to do. It was a lot of disease. And the question was, should we start a systemic treatment or is this patient still eligible for transurethral chemoembolization? The border is usually, you know, if there is less than 50% involvement of the liver, and, you know, once tumors become really big, it gets kind of dicey with the TACE. And in this case, we finally decided to start with the TACE, and our interventional radiologists, sometimes what they do is they don't TACE completely with the first session. They start and treat some of the disease and see how the patient responds to this and then repeat the TACE. So he tolerated the treatment very well. And we repeated the TACE. I believe we repeated the TACE 4 or 5 times and kept him actually stable for quite some time. More than a year, he was doing very well with this treatment. And the liver disease, the different tumors in the liver were under control with this TACE treatment. Unfortunately, at one point, we noticed that he developed extrahepatic disease and small lung metastasis.
He was asymptomatic still?
Well, I wouldn't say he was asymptomatic. He did have pain because he really had a lot of liver disease. But, you know, it was very easy to manage. You know, he didn't require a lot of pain medication and he had lost some weight to begin with when he was diagnosed. Now, a lot of times things are more complicated. This patient actually also has a diabetes and he was very strict with his diabetes. He was very concerned that he would gain too much weight for his diabetes. So it was very difficult for us to assess if it was really the disease or if it was basically, you know, that he was too strict on his diet. Usually, you know, we try patients with an HCC, you know, not to be too strict on a diet for their diabetes. But anyhow, so in this case, he did have some symptoms. He did have some pain. He didn't have any lung-related issues. But on the CT scan, we did find a number of nodules, both sides of the lung. And we decided to treat the patient systemically. Now, at that point, so remember, this is a patient I mentioned that had a lot of disease in the liver. Initially, you know, we were not sure whether to do a TACE or, you know, start straight out with the systemic treatment. So we were aiming for something where we can, at that point, see a little bit higher response rate than with the sorafenib that has been reported, and we discussed about this earlier. So we started the patient on lenvatinib, just hoping that he would benefit from this treatment and that the lesions in the liver were under control but large would respond to this treatment. And he was fine for a period of time. He tolerated the treatment. We had to dose reduce a little bit in the beginning, but then, you know, he tolerated the treatment. He developed some fatigue, I have to say. That was an issue for this patient, but we treated him, I believe, for 6 or 8 months approximately.
Did he have hypertension?
In this case, no. Actually, he didn't develop any hypertension, no.
So from your point of view, do you think the fatigue was related to the lenvatinib?
I believe it was in his case because, you know, we don't have really any other reason to believe. You know, there was no clear tumor progression at that time.
And did he have actual objective tumor shrinkage?
No, it was a stabilization. If you remember, you know, we knew this patient, so we did scans every 8 to 10 weeks. So we knew there was nothing in the liver, and then we followed on, and there was no further growth in the lung.
So before we go on, I am kind of curious. I always ask people trying to figure out this. I mean, I don't know how relevant it is right now, but it was relevant until a couple of months ago, the lenvatinib versus sorafenib. And one of the things I kind of have been trying to figure out is how do those two drugs affect quality of life? Because when I think about hypertension, I don't necessarily think about people feeling bad. But yet I have heard about fatigue and systemic problems with lenvatinib. Any way you can compare the two in terms of how people feel?
You know, that's, to be honest, my experience has been very similar with lenvatinib and sorafenib. You know, it's not that I see major differences. I think that's very hard to say.
What about hand-foot?
I was going to say, I think it's fair to say that you see more hand-foot with sorafenib. There's no question about that, yes.
So in any event, he goes on lenvatinib, has some fatigue, but tolerates it okay, I guess. And then I guess 8 or 9 months later, he has progression?
Yes. So, you know, I mentioned he didn't show an objective response. His AFP actually went down a little bit. But then, you know, it started to rise again. And, you know, sometimes it's very difficult to measure liver disease. But there were some small lesions in the liver that, in combination with an increase in his AFP, which clearly suggested tumor progression. So at that point, we decided, you know, and remember the patient was fatigued, so he was really not too fond of adverse events. So we decided to put the patient on pembrolizumab, which he tolerated quite well. And he showed, again, an initial disease stabilization, and we treated him for another 6 months. AFP, again, dropped a little bit.
Did he say, wow, this pembrolizumab is making me feel a lot better? Because really what was happening was he wasn't getting lenvatinib.
But that's, you know, yes, you're absolutely right. But, you know, that's what the patients tell you. They say, you know, this drug is just so much better. You know, it doesn't cause the adverse events and it makes me feel better, as you said, yes.
Is that what he said? Did he find life better off of the, you know?
Oh, yes. No, I mean, you know, and that's one other reason why, you know, in retrospect, I believe that the fatigue came from the treatment.
Interesting. So no autoimmune problems, hepatic function was stable.
Well, that's something that I would be very careful with. So we find a lot of endocrine disorders, you know, thyroid dysfunction. In this case, the patient did develop some thyroid dysfunction.
Really? Became hypothyroid?
Yes, which we see a lot. I mean, that's something that we see quite frequently. You know, it doesn't make us nervous anymore. Patients, in most cases, are completely asymptomatic. You see the most interesting constellations of TSH and T3, T4, but in most cases without any symptoms, so that it doesn't necessarily require that we interrupt the treatment.
Any skin problems? I hear about that too.
Well, we do find skin problems. Those are, to be honest, they have been mainly minor. There's a few cases that I can remember where we had severe skin problems, but in most cases, topical steroids really do their job. And, you know, this is basically coming out of practice. You know, sometimes there are issues that you wouldn't think of. What are you doing with a single patient? This was not this patient, but, you know, a patient that lives alone, they develop skin rash on their back.
Right.
You know, this is not this case, but, you know, I actually had a case. It was a female patient, and she developed a skin rash on her back, but she didn't have anybody to apply the cream to her back. So even a simple AE can actually turn out quite difficult for the patient. But in this case, you know, I said it was mainly the thyroid dysfunction, and he was doing well for approximately 6 to 8 months.
And then what happened?
Well, then, you know, he progressed. He was doing still very well, so cabozantinib was given to this patient. And that's basically something that we just started about 6 weeks ago. So, we, you know, so far he's tolerating it pretty well, I have to say. I was a little bit skeptical in the beginning after his experience on the lenvatinib, how we will tolerate this. But I have to say, so far, he's been doing pretty well.
Yeah, it's really been hard to tease out the TKIs. You know, ramucirumab is a little bit of a different story. But in terms of, you know, for example, lenvatinib, regorafenib, sorafenib, cabozantinib, both in terms of tolerability and efficacy. I mean, of course, they're not much in way of head-to-head comparisons, but I kind of feel like I'm seeing more people go to cabozantinib. I'm not sure if they think it's more efficacious or better tolerated or both. I mean, I see you did it in this person. It was just a couple weeks ago. So is that the way you're approaching it?
Well, you know, remember, so the different drugs that we have are regorafenib. We know patients have to tolerate sorafenib. We have ramucirumab, patients have to have a high AFP. So cabozantinib is kind of a, you know, I guess we shouldn't say this, but it's a little bit more of a one-fits-all drug. So that's, I think, why you see it being used more than the other drugs.
Well, that's interesting. So if you look at what happened to this man, so 5 TACEs, lenvatinib, pembrolizumab, cabozantinib, that was, I'm guessing, not an unusual algorithm for you until a couple months ago. So my question is, if you look back on this case and you saw this person right from the beginning, would you still do it the same way?
To be honest, I think I would, because remember, when I first saw the patient, you know, we have our tumor board and we had the discussion, systemic treatment versus local regional therapy TACE. And he had a lot of disease and, you know, it was, you know,
Okay. So
in this case, I think we would do the same thing again. I think we were actually already proactive here.
So in terms of, though, your first systemic therapy or your systemic therapy sequencing, in him it was lenvatinib, pembro, and cabozantinib. What do you think it would be today?
Well, nowadays, I mean, there's a good chance that I would have used a combination of atezo-bev instead of the lenvatinib as a first-line treatment.
And then what about second-line?
Well, you know, and then obviously it becomes difficult. And I would probably, in this case, have used the Carbo as a second line. But to be honest, I can't give you a good reason why I would have used this.
Could you at any point see yourself using an anti-CTLA-4, anti-PD-1 combination like Ipi-Nivo in a patient who'd previously had Atezo-Bev at some point?
That is an interesting question. And I don't think we know anything yet about the secondary resistance mechanism in HCC. We do know them, obviously, from melanoma because that's where we started. And some of the resistance mechanisms that have been described, such as mutation in beta-2 microglobulin, you know, they would argue that even the combination is not effective because basically antigens are no longer presented by the tumors. So it doesn't matter how active you really make the T cells, whether you use a combination of anti-CTLA-4 and anti-PD-1 or just anti-PD-1.
One other sequencing question. One of the things I saw on the survey that we just did is people talking about using Atezo-Bev second line. So we presented a patient who got started on lenvatinib-sorafenib a few months ago. Now they have progression. We saw people talking about Atezo-Bev second line. Is that something you would consider?
Well, you know, it depends on if you have a patient that has been on systemic treatment for a long period of time, and now you ask him, you know, before, you know, we knew about the Atezo-Bev treatment and he was started on systemic treatment, now you're asking me what is going to be a good second-line treatment for this patient. Let's say, you know, he's been on sorafenib for a year or so. I think, you know, yes, absolutely, it would be an option.
So let's hear about your second patient, a younger patient, 40 years old, who has chronic HBV and then, I guess, presented with a pretty big mass.
Yes, so that's a... To be honest, this is quite an unusual case, but you know, it actually speaks for the efficacy of checkpoint inhibitors. So this was a young 40-year-old Asian chronic hepatitis B infection, and he was diagnosed with a large lesion, 7.5 times 6 centimeters, single lesion in the liver, and he underwent a partial hemihepatectomy a number of years ago, I think 4 or 5 years ago. And there was no adjuvant treatment followed upon this treatment. And what they noticed was that initially he presented after a couple of months with a little bit of ascites and an abdominal mass, which I guess was basically a seeding metastasis from the surgery. And at that point, the disease, and this was before I got to know the patient, I should say, at this point, it was considered to be a systemic disease, extrahepatic disease, and he was treated with sorafenib. He didn't tolerate the sorafenib at all. He developed severe hand-foot skin reaction. And in this case, you know, the patient was reevaluated. He went to a different center and he was reevaluated for surgical resection of this extrahepatic metastasis in the abdominal wall. I believe the colleagues did a PET. They couldn't find anything else in his liver or anywhere else in the body. And he underwent a second resection of these metastases. And then he was NED for a couple of months. After that, he actually developed a couple of small new nodules, again, in the abdominal wall. They were up to 3.5 centimeters, but at this point, it was no longer only one lesion, but it was actually, were up to three, and one was attached to the small bowel. So that's when we started seeing the patient, and we started treating him at that point with anti-PD-1. You know, remember, he had already undergone one resection for metastatic disease. And the patient actually not only tolerated this treatment very well, but he also developed stable disease for a period of time. So we followed this patient, I believe, for more than a year. And the abdominal disease was stable. And at that point, we decided, okay, if we have a young fellow, 40 years of age, that has metastatic disease that is relatively easy resectable. Remember, I said in this case, it was in the abdominal wall and there was one lesion attached to the small intestine. So the patient underwent resection of the disease, which happened, I believe, in 2016, and he has been NED since then.
He's still on therapy, though?
He's without anything.
It was stopped at the time of the surgery?
He stopped without, yes, he was treated actually after the surgery. I believe we treated him for another 3 to 4 months, and then he stopped treatment completely.
Which PD-1 agent was he getting?
He was getting pembrolizumab.
So, what do you think's going on here?
Well, remember, at one point earlier today, we talked about the neoadjuvant treatment. You know, and you can consider this actually a neoadjuvant treatment, and I don't want to go too much into the details, but this is interesting because there is very little disease, but there is tumor antigens present. You prime the T cells. You know, you obviously, you know, you do see some responses. Patient did show tumor progression before the treatment. Then he was stable for 12 months. So a lot of signs that you really mount a specific immune response in this patient, which was probably then, you know, lasting much longer after the surgery.
Do you think that potentially the surgery could explain everything?
Well, you know, there is this idea of abscopal effects from surgery, but, you know, I haven't really seen this with HCC. I know it's been reported for renal cell carcinoma, but I don't know, with HCC, that's very hard to believe.
I'd like to hear also about your 45-year-old medical doctor from Africa. That sounds like a tough situation.
Yes, so that's a tough situation. So this was a medical doctor in Africa, and he was actually infected with hepatitis C, and, you know, with the new drugs, he tried to treat himself in Africa, and he got some drugs which turned out to be, you know, I don't know how he got them, but basically he failed to clear his hepatitis C infection. He came to a conference in the United States and then developed severe abdominal pain, went to the emergency room, and basically, you know, was diagnosed with a large HCC. The first complication in this particular case, and this is something that we don't see very often, but it does happen, but again, it's not very often. He actually developed a severe bleed from the biopsy at that time.
Wow. Was his HCV controlled at that point?
No, his HCV was not controlled. And that, you know, is actually one of the main problems for this particular case, because so we started treating the patient systemically, I believe, with sorafenib in this case, which, you know, he kind of tolerated okay, but not too well. Now, the problem in this case, you know, he progressed on this, was that on the sorafenib, he already developed, apart from skin reaction, transaminitis. So ALT, AST is really the main issue that we had in this particular case, apart from the tumor progression, and I'm going to come back to this in a second. So he progressed on systemic treatment with a TKI, and at one point, we put him on a checkpoint inhibitor, anti-PD-1 again. Now, on the anti-PD-1 treatment, he developed, again, an increase of ALT, AST, and that was a big question because, remember, the patient also has hepatitis C. Now, the question was, what is causing the ALT, AST increase? Is it his hepatitis, the viral hepatitis, or is it drug-related hepatitis? So the interesting thing in this case is we were able, because it's an hepatitis C patient, to actually monitor the hepatitis C viral load. And we could see that the hepatitis viral load increased significantly and explained the increase in ALT, AST. Now, in other cases in the past, we and others have seen that checkpoint inhibitors suppress actually hepatitis C RNA levels because you activate T cells not only specific for the tumor, but also against the virus. So in this case, giving him a checkpoint inhibitor was actually very helpful again because it also basically improved his hepatitis again and made the ALT, AST level go back to normal.
Wow. What's his current situation?
Well, unfortunately, this patient also progressed at one point, again, also with some, in this case, he actually had some mediastinal disease. And we started a second line treatment, but you mentioned in the beginning, this became a very difficult social situation because he was from Africa and his family was in Africa. And you know, I didn't feel comfortable to treat the patient here all the time and basically recommended for him to go back to Africa at one point.
Subsequent to this interview, on March 10th, 2020, the FDA granted accelerated approval to the combination of nivolumab plus ipilimumab for the treatment of patients with HCC. The approval was based on results from cohort 4 of the CheckMate 040 trial for patients with HCC who had progressed or were intolerant to sorafenib. The study reported an overall response rate of about 30% with nivolumab ipilimumab with an acceptable safety profile. This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Hepatocellular Carcinoma Update.